episode 11.
Episode 11 already.
This far already.
Jeez. All the statistics. So today we're going to talk about our
How
journey.
How did we get into DevOps?
Yeah, interesting. Like, it's not sure how long this episode will take, actually, but we'll see.
Yeah, maybe the first 10 years are not very interesting to
it depends on how old you are, I think, because for some people it will seem familiar, and for others it will not say anything.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if that has a lot related to DevOps itself. I mean, it probably has something related to IT, like how did we get interested in IT. My first computer when I was, I think, 6 years old was a Macintosh SE. So I think you get like your first computer to get you hooked to computers, internet. Well, not internet, but IT in general, you know. Like.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, internet, no. That wasn't there yet. No, exactly.
Although I think there was a way very soon after to connect the modem, but it was very, very difficult, very expensive.
You have to pay the phone rates like per minute.
That was expensive.
That was expensive, and you couldn't use the landline anymore to actually
nobody
make
could call
phone
you anymore.
Yeah, but that was later. I think it
was
90
somewhere.
Yeah, exactly, somewhere. Exactly. Yeah. Like,
so yeah, we were both born in 85. To give a reference frame,
the edge of millennials.
And in the 90s, I think actually everything changed once you connect to the internet, because when you have a computer, you just use it to play games and to test a few things. But once you are connected to the internet, it's like, oh, there's all this information. Like you can read how-tos and books. And I think that's how I actually first got to read about programming. And if I remember correctly, that was about a C program language, because back then that was like, okay, if you want to learn programming, learn C.
Wasn't that much choice either.
Like, yeah, now, well, you have like things like BASIC and all the other things as well. True. But still, we're like, oh yeah, just use C, because that's what is used a lot, which is actually much more difficult to learn nowadays. You can just learn Python. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't have such a steep learning curve as C. I remember, like, okay, chapter 3 was like pointers, so you don't really have these with Python or other languages, and then like pointers, functions. But yeah, it gives you good basics to get started.
For sure.
I think. But yeah, programming doesn't immediately bring you closer to anything like internet services. And I think when going back, internet services, like everything that's on the internet, like websites, that's what changed everything, I think. That's how you
the accessibility to it.
Yeah, but also that's how you kind of get to try to understand how everything works.
True, the same for me. Like, at some point, like my neighbors across the street were super tech savvy, so they had their father was like a mainframe engineer at a big European bank, and he already had a way of dialing into the system if something broke, and like with modems and stuff like that. But that was like processors 386, 486, some things like that. So like a real old machines. And then it were like stupid things so they had, I think three computers. And basically when you like the first, it's really, really stupid, but the first versions of Doom, you were able to play them together over like a network connection with coax. And then you had to set it up yourself, like with IPX, something like that,
in
MS-DOS, that you had to set that up first. And it was like, you know, the commands, you start learning, like, I have to type this in order to achieve that. But then you start realizing, like, after I got older and older, now, like, how does this actually work? And then you start asking questions. And then they also had the knowledge and the literature to show, like, but you're actually like starting up this, and this is how your network works. And I was like, whoa, this is amazing that two computers can speak to each other. And you also had like Formula One that you can play like against each other the same way. Also with a coax cable and terminators, that, because you had to terminate that network, was super funny. And then in the later stage, they had a thing like a BBS, like the precursor of the internet, I think it was. Like
you dialed precursor news.
Yeah, bulletin board services, basically. Yeah. So you basically dial in into a computer. There were also a limited amount of slots that people could dial in, and then you were able to access some information. Like not all of them very useful, but like it was the first way of like also you had a kind of chat room kind of ish, and I was like, whoa, what is this? So this, I'm dialing into a computer that is like 50 kilometers away from me. It's completely, and I'm talking to strangers in kind of real time. And then basically, internet was just around the doorstep, at least in Europe, like where I was living. Internet providers came around and stuff like that. And then you start browsing the internet, and then like that I always was curious on how stuff worked, like because they also built their PCs there themselves, like buying processors, motherboards, all that stuff. So I was always looking how they were doing that. And then you visit the website, like fast forward a bit, and then you start to think like, how is this possible? And then you start
to learn
HTML.
This.
Yeah, and then you start to learn HTML. You already have an idea of the networking. And
how would you learn it? Because now you go and buy a course on Udemy. I remember going to...
Oh, the bookstore.
Take the bus to the bookstore.
Yeah, to the nearest town. Exactly.
Yeah, buy the HTML book that was like this. Yeah.
And there were magazines as well.
Magazines.
Clicks magazine, I think the name was.
PC magazine from PC the Netherlands or something.
Yeah, exactly. And that was like a big source of information. You always get that CD from CompuServe. you would have like hundreds and thousands of those at the end of your 10 years.
Yeah, I think... one of these magazines said like, oh, Linux is this new thing.
Exactly.
And that's how I started like looking it up. But that was already the day that I figured out that IRC existed. Because you can also get a lot of information from IRC, talking to people. They're a bit more tech savvy people that are on IRC. So I think at some point when we had internet, I joined IRC, and then you start experimenting with all these things that you find interesting when you are.
Absolutely.
I don't know how old I was. 14, 15, 16, I don't remember. I remember like egg drops or something that we would spend some time on.
Way too much, actually.
Way too much time. Way too much time, yeah. But then indeed, and then there was like one day's magazine that said like, Linux, this new thing. And I was like, huh. But I didn't have access to install it. I want to install it, but I couldn't get it. And I actually remember trying to download it using my dial-up. Yeah. Like it had like these downloaders that would be able to resume over FTP. So it took me like a month or two to download it. I downloaded it, burned it on CD, and actually I got into the installer and everything, but then it's like, oh, there's a RPM, those Red Hat RPM package corrupt. And I was like, oh, something got corrupt. And could never get installed it. So then I actually went to the same bookstore where I bought this HTML book, and they also had books about Linux with installation
box.
CDs.
With that box?
Yeah, like some box with like Red Hat 6 or something, which is not the Red Hat 6, I mean the restart numbering or something. It's Red Hat 6 from, I mean, a long time ago, 42,000, I think, or around 2000 somewhere. And then you could read the book. And that was quite interesting to learn about Linux. You would get the CDs, you would install it, and you would read a book how to install it. What are the shell commands? What is bash?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that would actually give you a lot of information. The only downside that I had was, you would install Linux, but it wouldn't recognize my modem, so I couldn't go on the internet with Linux. I had to wait actually until I had like broadband before I could actually connect my Linux
interesting
server.
I remember PC. It was a big hassle to get that in order. It was
Win modems or something. It was not easy.
Exactly.
But then you also had like what I did at some point was you could have like a router Because but in back in the day, it was like, oh, you have one PC and this one PC can connect to the internet. And then I would have this old PC, and then I would put a diskette in the old PC that would boot some kind of mini Linux that had IP tables, and then that would be your router.
Oh, yeah,
Then you
exactly.
connect that to a switch. I think it's like Coyote Linux or something.
Yeah.
Connect that to a switch, and then you can add everything to like we can create a home network. And I remember that the internet companies back in the day are saying that it's illegal.
Yeah,
Like you're not
you
allowed to
couldn't
do
share it.
that.
No, exactly,
No
yeah.
sharing allowed. There's only your
Yep.
license only valid for one PC. Otherwise you need some other license or something. You're like,
Yeah,
we are
that
doing something illegal
floppy.
here.
How was the name again? It doesn't matter, but yeah. We had the same thing because my brother PC was next to mine, and then like the old computer, you even had like a modem for DSL that was able to do that, but they limited that thing, so you had to flash new firmware on that DSL modem. It was like an expensive Alcatel modem, I think it was, like with an Ethernet port, and then you basically could flash it with another firmware, and then basically you
Oh,
had a DHCP server on it. But it was in a way later stage, then we already had broadband. But
yeah. What I was talking about, we also already had broadband. I don't think we ever shared internet or using the modem because that was just
oh yeah,
way
we
too
did.
slow.
Yeah, it was
You did? Oh,
5 kilobytes. Yeah, so if
yeah.
one was, but yeah, we were with two people who wanted to
Oh,
watch
yeah.
him, and my brother also, he helped a lot in that. So also, I
He was older,
always,
right?
yeah, he was 7 years
Older,
older.
yeah.
So he already had broadband access in his school, and then internet at home. So he persuaded my parents that that was a useful thing. We should do that, stuff like that. But he like back in the day, I also, because I learned how to like install computers, like basically put them together
The
from
hardware.
pieces, the hardware. I started selling them to people in my class, but I was like 12, 13 years old, I think, when I started with that. So it's not very convincing for the parents to be like, I'm gonna buy a computer built by a 12-year-old, because it looked complex back then, while it's still kind of the same thing. So my brother was he financed me basically
Also, salesperson.
Oh, see, I'm doing thumbs up again. But no, he financed me to buy the pieces, then took a piece of the profit, and then, but it looked like he built it. Like that was way more trustworthy to be able to sell it, right? But that's yeah, I've always been interested in how stuff works, and that curiosity has led me kind of also in that path, I think.
Yeah, I think back in the day we would kind of, like you say, like you would flash the firmware. There would still be this way, this hacker mindset. Like you have
Yeah.
something,
Oh, that phone
let's change it
phreaking
in,
and all that stuff.
yeah, let's change it in some way. Let's experiment. You could read on the internet like how to do things, and that was the area. Because yeah, I remember also like that were like the time that you would experiment with Linux. You also had these hacking challenges that I found somewhere, like a website, and said like, there's somewhere a bug in this website. This is level one. Find the bug, and you will go to level two. And then the challenge would always get more complex. And that's like I spent so many hours on that. So much
Bounty
time.
programs, kind of like they're called now, right? Like it's the same thing with not that it's the same, but it reminds me of like so IRC got like, we used it since forever, and then all of a sudden you had like Slack popping up again after so many years of not really using IRC, and then
So
you're
yeah, I
like,
know what this is.
this looks awful familiar. So you see also things coming back that
Definitely.
worked well. So that was thing, but also the curiosity was also a thing that you learn how to program, because it started really like my mom had some recipes, and I found a book about, I think it was Turbo Pascal, something like that, I think it was back in the day, whatever. And I tried to create it myself, but like my English wasn't that good back then, and the book was in English. And I tried to like put pieces together, and then yeah, basically you start from there, I think. And the cool thing is, but it's also we discussed in our previous episode that how many levels there are of stuff that you have to kind of know, but that we take for granted that we know that, is kind of also because of that, I think.
It was much more obvious what the abstraction levels were there because we didn't have so many abstraction levels, I think.
Yeah, when it was an iteration of all skills. Yeah.
There was no button to connect your two PCs. You need to set up this protocol. You're exposed to the protocol and you have to connect everything.
To play a game.
Yeah. And then you're just like, I want to play this game.
So that was the motivator. True.
Yeah, that's the motivator. Yeah.
Absolutely. I spent a lot of Saturday evenings playing Doom while I was actually too young to play it, but that's another thing. No, and then also like, we've tried some HTML on your, I think,
Netscape. I remember that was still the time of Netscape, because then when I was learning HTML, it was like, are you going to use tables to do your layout because then it's still Netscape compatible, or are you going to use CSS, and CSS like, oh, this new thing. But then there was CSS, so then I had to buy another book about CSS because the HTML book was only about HTML. Then you had to buy CSS. And then they said XML. XML is the future. So I bought an XML book because XML is the future. And then I started learning. Then I bought a PHP book. That's how I remember.
Yeah.
PHP 5, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Probably.
They would teach you about how to make a web shop in PHP, and then MySQL, and MySQL, like this database.
Exactly.
That was like, whoa, you know, you can do like these queries.
That was for me a catalysator for going from like client side things to like server side things, and then also want to understand how the server side things work, not just pushing. Here is a picture and it goes through the wire and it stands on a disk, but now it's like rendering the content dynamically. It's fetching it from somewhere. MySQL, it's a database and you set it up locally, you put a zoom and then it works. But then like, but I want to run this on a server. How would that work? And what are the consequences of that?
And also, the funny thing is that, well, you don't have a job, or you were not like, you have limited resources.
Yeah.
So how do you do it? So you look for the most inexpensive way. It's not like, well, now we can make a cloud account for free. Okay, maybe you need a credit card. Sometimes you don't need a credit card, but like back then it was not so obvious indeed. So you
like a DigitalOcean machine, boom, ready to go.
You would scour the internet, look for some free services somewhere that had like FTP access, maybe shell access if you were lucky, to then put your website on. All the static websites were for free, I remember, but dynamic websites, that was not for free.
That is kind of where you jumped in as well, right? Like,
yes, because I remember, because I was on IRC and then I found some people that had servers, and they said to me, yeah, we have these servers somewhere in the data centers. Like, oh, data center, what is that?
exactly.
And then we have a very big internet connection, like, I don't know, 100 Mbits. I was like, 100 Mbits is like, or first it was 10 and then 100. And it's like, how do you get a server in a data center? You can rent one. Or actually, at first they would rent one in the US, because in Europe it was much more expensive. And in the US they would have like a data center, like a very cheap something where you would just have desktops and then connect it. So first you could get some account there, which was not even a full server, just an account. But then I figured out like, for like, I don't know, not much, $300, $400, $500 maybe, you could build a server. And then I was like, it needs to be a one unit server. And then you could get some parts from somewhere and then someone would build it for me. And then I found some other guys that said like, I also want some account somewhere to run my website on, maybe just to have like shell access to run some tests. So I found like five people. Okay, I will buy this server. Let's get it into a data center, and then we'll divide it up in five. I will manage it, and then we will have our own server to put our websites on, to put whatever on. And indeed, then it kind of starts like, but we need DNS. Like, we need a domain name. How does this work? You need to install DNS server. I need to install that. And yeah, from there you learn a lot of things. And I was still in high school back then. I was already thinking I will go and study like computer science or something similar. But at that point, that was like the what you would get in school was like, here's Excel, here's Word, you know.
Exactly.
There was computer classes, but it's more like, oh, you can learn how to type without looking at your fingers, you know. And there was a little bit of programming as well, Visual Basic, but that was like really like very like the minimal things. And then back then I was like, oh, but Visual Basic is not very interesting because now everything is a website, so why don't we learn PHP?
Yeah, absolutely,
But yeah,
absolutely.
that was like PHP, what are you talking
It
about?
was the same with me in high school. It was I was trying to I was first doing electronics, and then I was not that interested anymore into that. And then I was looking at like computer science, but the options were limited back then. And then I find a school like 60 kilometers away from here or something like that that had like industrial computer science, and I was like. It was like assembler, electronics, Visual Basic, and like programming, like those big assembly robots, like they have in like factories. I was like, yeah, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do. So I did that actually in order to avoid like the Excel and all that stuff, because that was the classical trajectory for most schools was like, ah, oh, you want to do something with computers? Here's Excel and Word and stuff like that. I was like.
The funny thing was actually that the reason why they would do it like that is that the it, you the course was actually accounting
Yeah, exactly.
and IT, or well, what they would call IT. And it's like, yeah,
Exactly.
if you know Excel, you will be a good accountant. If you learn Word, you'll be a good accountant. So it was all aimed like you can become an accountant with now these things that you have learned.
Which is crazy, right? Well, yeah, luckily that has
But
changed.
the and that was quite interesting. I actually one of the benefits of doing that, and one of the things that I wanted was, you would actually get a certificate that you could open a company.
Oh
Because
yeah.
opening a company, you needed some kind of certificate that you need you knew like the
Yeah.
basics of
Like company knowledge certificates. Yeah, exactly.
back in Belgium. So I needed that because I wanted to start my own company because I had already a server, and I was like, once I have my company, I can sell more of this
Yeah.
accounts, and then I can make maybe a small profit. So I remember the day I was 18, I went to this office to that can do the paperwork
For the VAT number.
for a VAT number and a company number, and then I like immediately there was like a reality check because they just kind of changed at the government level all their systems. So they told me like, oh yeah, we just changed our system. So normally you would get it in a day, but now we're just changing it. So I don't know how long. And it actually took 2 or 3 months to get the
Oh,
VAT number
wow.
back then. Oh, they're very, very strange. It's like, what is going on here? But yeah, and then once I got the VAT number, I was like 18 a couple of months. The 18 is like the minimum age in Belgium to start a company. Then I started selling these accounts, like to put websites on, dynamic websites on, like what was it, GSP and PHP and MySQL from a server in the Netherlands, which are later brought back to Belgium at some point when the prices were better in Belgium. This is all already years later. That's how it started. And then that was my side business when I was then doing my bachelor's in, I think, what was it, 2003? Started 2003, yeah. And then you went to the same school. That's how we actually met. Around 2005, I think, or something, right? Because I didn't met you immediately in the school. I first did like 2 years or something, and then I met you. Because we joined. So when I joined the school, I found out that I was like a student organization. And the student organization would promote free and open software. And I was like, oh yeah, Linux, free, open source, cool, I will join that. And then they were like, oh, we manage these servers here. We also have these accounts, like the same accounts, same shell accounts, because people maybe wanted a website or wanted to program on the server for their courses. So they were managing that, and they were also doing events like workshops, Linux workshop, Vim workshop, Perl workshop, all these kind of things. So I joined that, and you joined that one also
Yeah,
later, couple of
exactly.
years later. So that's how we met, actually.
Even building Wi-Fi antennas and cooking workshops.
Pringles, from a Pringles, yeah.
From
how
Pringles
to build
can.
An antenna. From, yeah,
and cooking for IT people. Like that was also
that was nice.
It was also a popular one.
Because they had kitchens, because they had some other courses where they needed kitchens, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, for diets and yeah, that's actually how we met, through the student affiliation. And then later you became president of that, I think, even.
Yeah.
And then I took over because I liked my high school too much. So I stayed in high school a little longer.
one year longer or something, no?
Exactly. I doubled a year because I switched from electronics to that other, like, and then you had a big gap on math. So I had mathematics, not the drugs.
And the student affiliation, the interesting part was that it was actually promoting free and open source software, which was not very known back then. They were saying, like, there's Linux, but that's Linux just one part of it. There is this GNU thing, and then there's FOSDEM, which is a yearly event in Belgium that we would go to. So there was a lot of exposure to new things that the student affiliation was doing, and also programming languages, things like Perl. Perl was like a big thing back then.
Absolutely.
2003, around 2003. Maybe it was already dying down.
Yeah, but it was also in the curriculum of the school, I think. So
No, I don't think so. It was not in the curriculum. Actually, that was quite funny, right? Because the curriculum of school back then was, unfortunately, that you still had to learn COBOL.
Oh, yeah, COBOL. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, COBOL. I don't know if you... Did you have to learn this one? Yeah.
Yep. Well, it was like... relatively simple.
In my time, it was like, we are not teaching PHP. No. We don't know whether that will be...
It's not proven tech. No,
that's proven tech, which I was already doing before I went there. So I was like, okay, whatever. I already know how to program in PHP. I have a few websites. No. We're going to teach you COBOL. And back then, you also don't know. So you think like, oh, COBOL, yeah, that must be the thing. That's how we write these business applications.
I got taught PHP. Yeah.
Yeah, but that did change it. Because then
exactly.
It was proven. when I left, it was proven. Yeah. So COBOL, but then also they introduced Java, also from the first year, and then Java is more modern, and it's crazy that it's still around, you know, so long. That I wouldn't think that what you learn back then, like Java, you think IT it goes very fast, but yeah, business software is not going very fast. We're still doing Java everywhere, right? So
yeah, absolutely,
it's crazy that we already started. I started in 2003 with Java. We are now 21 years later, and everything's still Java.
Yeah, definitely.
That's completely crazy. But yeah, that was what COBOL also was. COBOL was like, if you want a good job and you know COBOL, you're going to have a job tomorrow.
Yeah, you can work in a bank and rewrite the software. Like, because they needed a lot of people during the 2000 Y2K bug.
But then there were a lot of people indeed that want to go to these bachelors to learn about IT, and because there was like a hype, but then it kind of died down a little bit, and then we were like already on where there was a lot less people, but COBOL was still big. And then the interesting part actually is we went to FOSDEM, free and open source, what is that abbreviation?
Free and open source development
meetup. M is a strange meetup.
Meeting.
Yeah, meetup was another thing back then, I think. Meeting.
Something like
and
that.
And they said like, oh, you can do your LPI exam for no money, like 50%, 80% reduced or something. So like, oh, LPI, what is that? And then you get your LPI ID, you do the exam on paper.
Yeah, I still have the pencil. Sometimes I find it in my... I have like a junk box, and I throw everything in there that I want to keep, and it's like the LPI pencil.
And that's kind of how it gets more professionalized. You're like, okay, this is what I need to learn, isn't it? What I need to know to maybe be able to get a job as a system administrator. Like DevOps wouldn't exist back then. Cloud didn't exist. It was still like putting service in racks. But then you would be a system administration because these things need to be managed. Kind of as pets, what we say now, right? Now we say, okay, you want cattle, not pets, but that was all Everything was a pet.
Yeah, absolutely. It was all custom. You try to not divert too much, and that's where all those strict big corporate IT processes come from, I think. Like to because else, like, nothing would be the
everything
same.
Everything same operating system. Everything same packages. Yep. Yeah.
Patching goes through all those pillars from development, acceptance, production, all that stuff, which kind of absolutely makes sense, right? Like, it's super important. But it comes from that, because else, yeah, it was no way of doing that, and you learned that.
So going back to like our DevOps journey, I think that was kind of the level where I say like, okay, now I can become a system administrator because I did this LPI. Now I feel more certain that
that I'm actually able to do something.
There was also system administration courses in the curriculum, but they were like super boring, you know, like very theoretical.
Yeah.
I mean, they are useful in a way, but not really practical, I find. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure maybe today I would find it super interesting, but back then I didn't find it very interesting. But then they changed the curriculum when you did your last year, and then they introduced Cisco, right? Cisco certification, yeah, CCNA. Exactly. And that I was kind of mad about, that I couldn't get that one. Because that was something that interested me. Like, I had a big interest in like, okay, I know system engineering, but what is going on in this network layer, routing protocols, switching protocols, BGP, and all these kind of things that I had an interest in, but couldn't really do. Which I then, during my internship, and then I learned a bit about that, and then little by little I caught up. But that's actually, if you want to be a good system administrator, you also should know about networking. That was kind of the thing, right?
Yep, exactly.
And CCNA would be a good, like, the way to learn about networking.
Yeah, like basic debugging tools, right? Like a ping, tracer, all that stuff that you can find.
Yeah, TCP dump, and then what, Wireshark, or what was it called? That you Wireshark, would like
can
see.
Intercept.
Yeah, I remember it. Like, what was it, war driving, or was it called that was
with
that
Wi-Fi.
Was, yeah, with the Wi-Fi. Was it called the word? Was it war driving?
War driving, yeah. With the laptop.
Yeah, you would take your laptop in the car, you would drive somewhere. Oh my god. And then you would put Wireshark on, and then you would see all the unencrypted, because encryption was not a thing back then. You would see all the unencrypted data. I never drove around, but at home I was like, I can just see my unencrypted data. And actually, as a kind of system administrator, I was like, I need to encrypt everything.
Yeah, exactly.
I think I installed a VPN or something, like some, like between the Wi-Fi and the router or something like that. Like, I was like, oh, this needs to be encrypted, because now otherwise people can read everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with the earliest form of encryption, it was so weak. But yeah, that's.
I don't think my VPN was weak, but I got a big performance hit if I would put the VPN on. Yeah, I had the. What was it?
The standard
first
web.
One. That's
WEP, I think it was.
Nobody. Yeah, but before that, nobody was using it. It was just open. You would buy a box, and then there would just be no encryption by default. And I remember there was no Wi-Fi. I was the first person in my neighborhood to plug in the Wi-Fi. There was just no Wi-Fi. You would click. There was only one. There was only one. And now you open your phone, and it's like, okay, there's 30 Wi-Fis around me. No, there was nothing. Nothing. Yeah.
Even Google Cars, like Google Street View, uses it to identify neighborhoods and stuff like that, to pinpoint locations better and stuff like
that. I remember. There was also software that said, now you can join a hotspot if you're there. There's a hotspot. You can go on the internet. You can take your, that wasn't a phone, it was a laptop. You could take your laptop.
Yeah.
And then actually there was also 3G. Then you could put like a card in your laptop, and then an antenna, and an antenna on your screen, and you would have 3G, which was super expensive.
Super slow as well.
Super slow, super expensive, yeah. So then I think after I graduated, so now we are like 2006, I had this web hosting company with the servers that was running in the Netherlands. So then I've also met some other people online, actually, and that were doing the same thing. And so I actually decided to merge my company together with another company, and we were actually doing for a couple of years web hosting. So we would just like sell these packages to and domain names to people that wanted to have a website, a dynamic website, because you also didn't have cloud. So people would say, I have a small company, I need to run an app. Can I get a server? We would buy a server, we would rent it to them, or they would buy a server and bring it to us, to our data center. We would move everything from... No, actually, at that point, my servers were already in Belgium in some facility. Then we moved them to another facility. And then we would have like a whole rack where we could put, I think, 42 servers or something. But yeah, 42 you could never put because you didn't have the power. Back then, the power was already limiting you of putting it full, like one new servers, because one server was like, I don't know, quite a high
the voltage,
energy usage. And you all, I think you had 16 amps or something, and that was the issue or something. And then you have to kind of, when I remember you had two electricity feeds, and then when 1 feed went down, you would have to switch to the other one. And if you put too many servers, when they boot up, they have a surge, and then everything would shut down if you would put too many servers. So then you could only, like, I don't know, put 8 amps, 9 amps, I don't remember, of servers or something, because when they boot up. And then, so we had quite a significant amount of servers, I think 1 or 2 racks or something when I left in 2009, because at some point it was just not interesting anymore. It's kind of the same thing over and over.
And then
there was some new things coming slowly, so like, do I want to do this for the rest of my life? No, not really. And also at some point the bigger players started to consolidate all these smaller ones, so eventually the company was also sold. But that's where we actually kind of lost contact, because
Then we drifted apart for a couple of years.
So what did you do actually after you graduated?
So I started working at a bank. So I had, long story short, like, I was looking at what I'm gonna do, and then like I was already following podcasts about San Francisco. I was like, that is so cool, I want to go there, without having like known any consequences of what it entails to move, visas, all that stuff. Just an idea of maybe I want to do something like that, like the world's your oyster or whatever. And then I got to know that I was going to become a father, so priorities changed a bit. But I already accepted a job to see like what I'm going to do, whatever, at a bank in Belgium. And I was a Unix engineer, basically. So I was responsible for an application that did the stock trading for like a couple of banks together. And I was like on a huge piece of machinery, like it was called an HP Superdome. It was completely like, it's like literally, it's just super big in the data center. And they had two, like, one in two facilities, basically, to have some redundancy. And that's where I basically got to know, like it was more Unix than Linux, but like kind of the same things, like automating in Bash, Perl, all that stuff. So I could use that into practice, actually. And that was quite interesting. Then I got to manage to lead the team. But I was in another department. It was more of an insourcing of other companies into the IT services of that bank, basically. And I was not that interested anymore. The stock trading was really cool because it was like low latency. It had a lot of challenges. It had to be 24/7. And then all of a sudden I had to was responsible for the things of a social secretary, and was like less, not that it was less interesting, but it was less like, less challenging for me. So then basically I was like, I also worked with Oracle, and I was like, maybe I want to do something with that. Like, Oracle DBA seems to make a lot of money. Basically, that was the motivation.
Oracle is expensive, so
exactly. So let's do that. Yeah. So I kind of pivoted to Oracle DBA for a couple of years.
What year are we now? 2008 or something?
Oh no, we're already at 2013 for me. So you have a lot of story to catch up as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think I worked in the bank for 4 years, 4 or 5 years, something like that. And then I moved away to a different company.
Going back to how this helps actually around becoming a DevOps engineer, is that if you are exposed to enterprise level procedures and like how everything works, it all ties back into operations. Like, how do you manage it? You need to have procedures, you need to have some kind of methodology to manage all these things, and you learn all these things when you are in a bigger organization. You don't really learn them in a small organization. So when I was in my own company, I was like, we didn't have a lot of procedures written down. So going back then to 2009 when I left this web hosting company, which was my own company. So I stopped doing, actually I continued a couple of years as a consultant there, but I kind of gave up my co-founder role, worked as a consultant. And in that time, I actually went to do my master's. I was very interested in economics and business, so I did a master's in that. But I also still want to keep the IT part, so which threw me in a complete different area of IT. Because if you are good in IT and also kind of management, economics, procedure things, you go more in the... Yeah, one of the things you can go into is compliance. So after the master's was 2 years, and then I started an internship at JP Morgan in New York. So I have to go to New York.
Nice.
So that was a big jump, I think. And then you, just like you were working in the bank, you would be exposed to procedures and then like how everything works. And that all, I find that all ties back into like the operations part of our job. Mm-hmm. So when you do, I was in information risk management. So we would go through the certifications. If someone had like ISO certified, yep, or SOC 2 or one of these, you had to have a lot of procedures in place. We needed to check these procedures, whether they were good enough, change management, physical access, logical access, all these kind of things. But that gives you a sense of what is necessary within a company on IT level to be in compliance, to be able to build services for example, banks. What are banks looking for when you have a vendor and the vendor wants to deliver some services?
Absolutely.
Not a lot of secrets there, actually. Like, when you're not in that world, you have no idea. But once you are there for a couple of weeks, you understand, like, okay, there's also certifications to become a certified auditor, kind of information risk auditor. There's like also books about that I bought and read. And then that gives you a lot of insights how corporations work. And I think that's really, I'm not saying that everyone should do that, but it gives you good basis like knowing kind of how you have to kind of structure a company, not really a company, but an organization, like what procedures are necessary, what's on an IT level. I mean, you can just read a book as well. You can just say, okay, if you have to become certified in something, you have to become SOC 2. What is necessary for SOC 2? You will also learn about it. But that's interesting to know that there's so much more than just the technical side. That you also have the controls, and you can also document it. So that was interesting to know. But yeah, eventually I also kind of said, like, it's interesting to know, but it's not the career path I want to follow. So yeah. Went from New York to London. But then I left JP Morgan in London to join another startup. So back then, what was really new and hyped was big data. So I went in 2014, I went to a big data startup. So when you kind of went to the Oracle side, I went to the big data side, I think. Hadoop, distributed computing. And that's throughout 2014, AWS was already around. Even when I was in New York, AWS was already around. That really kind of showed me how to do distributed computing, but also how to deploy on AWS. And there's not a lot of tooling around that we have today. Like, there was no Terraform. Like, Terraform was just new. Like, it couldn't do anything. But we were not using it because, you know, we were using Chef, for example, even to provision instances on AWS. I think AWS also had a Chef managed service at some point that they now deprecated, I think.
Even. Yeah, luckily. But it's also interesting because, like, the things that you're mentioning now is the things that you, in the big organizations a couple of years before that, you already learned the processes on how to do that. But instead of using Chef, you basically had a Word document with steps that you had to repeat to do the deploy and whatever. So you kind of, like, this is the first, in my opinion, like, kind of the first DevOps movement as well from an automation perspective, because you started automating things that you were like, if I misclick and miss a step here in this like Excel document or Word document, I screw up the release. Like, you were running queries on the database, next step, log into the database, next step, run this query, next step, create a table, drop that table, copy, whatever. And then basically you start to automating those things in shell scripts and stuff like that. So it was repeatable, and you could, like, releases had to happen at 10 p.m. on a Saturday until 6 a.m. on Sunday morning, like in the bank I was working at. So you had to make sure that you didn't need to kind of think about what you were doing. So you tried to automate those things, and then the tooling followed, not in big corporations, because that took a lot longer. Like, IBM tried to make some stuff around that and stuff like that. But basically they like the open source communities and stuff like that also saw that, and were like, then Chef came on the surface of the earth and stuff like that, to in order to just get rid of those shell scripts eventually as well and make it like in a better way, like so
in YAML with Ansible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it was repeatable. Yeah. It was like, yeah. That was the main goal. And then you didn't have to follow those boring Excel sheets or stuff like that.
No, but that's indeed it. I think the kind of movement started there with us as well, in that startup in London. Like, first you click everything together in AWS, and then it's like, okay, yeah, there's an API. We can actually use the API to launch some instances. Now these instances are launched, how do we provision them? Puppet was already around for a very long time. I remember even working with them like a long time before.
My Ents project was that for the bachelor degrees was with Puppet, because we had in the slideshow, the first thing was the mentors liked Metallica, so the first slide was from Metallica, the song from Masters of Puppet, because like we.
Yeah, so no.
We already had good points before with our first slide, but that's the thing.
Yeah, so this thing automation, we already kind of did that, just not on that level where we would do it in around 2014-15, I would say. And I think that's when it was more popularized, like this DevOps movement. Okay, it was a few years earlier that it kind of started, DevOps days and all these things, but yeah, there was not a lot of tooling, I remember, like, and also Chef was a bit clunky as well.
Yeah.
And then they would say, like, first you had like a daemonless or something, and then you had, oh, there's a server that you have, and then you would have to build the whole server, and then you had actually the managed server version, and then that was actually when there start to be like managed services, like SaaS for infrastructure. That was when things became interesting, I would say, because then people are like, I am doing operations, but now I don't have to manage all these software on service of my servers, but I can actually use finally some managed service. I was just paying the subscription somewhere, and now I have like only these clients. And that was that model, and that's also a little bit the cloud model, subscription based. That model kind of started changing things, I think. Like, you had the cloud, but also the subscriptions, infrastructure software subscriptions that you would then use to make life easier.
Absolutely. It's also around the time that our paths crossed again, because I had to do some Oracle training in London. And I had some budget on getting going to on training, and the first I had to do a certification of some kind. I don't remember how it was called. And I was in London. So I was like...
Yeah, and I introduced it to Uber, no? Uber?
Yeah, exactly. That was like... It was magic back then. It was like, you press it on your app. I had what was it? iPhone 2, I think. First didn't exist, but I had like the iPhone 2. And then basically you ordered it. I don't have to explain Uber, obviously, but it was like, it felt like magic. There was a guy picking me up, and they only had Uber Black back then. So it was like a big Audi A6.
Guy in a suit.
Yeah, and a guy in a suit. So exactly. So he opened the door, put you inside the car, and then drove off. And I remember that my colleagues were sitting at the bar of the hotel, and I was saying, yeah, I'm going to visit a friend. And then I came back like in his big car with a show, and he was like, whoa, who's your friend?
And they would open your door, no? It was like that.
Just have to sit, and they would open it like you're some kind of celebrity. It was amazing.
and they would give you credits to use it.
Yeah, yeah,
like
exactly.
The first ride would be for free, so like this guy picking you up for free, opening a door in a suit.
Sometimes come across when you search for keywords. Sometimes I come across in the iPhone photo library. So that was pretty funny. But yeah, then also we got, I was very interested in what you were doing, like Hadoop and AWS as well. I wasn't that super familiar with it. I knew it existed and was getting a big thing in the United States. And you saw like a wave coming back to Europe. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I'm going to learn more about that as well. So basically, beside the Oracle thing, I started learning AWS by myself. Also, it wasn't that hard back then because there weren't that many
services.
There was
no services.
Like, it was EC2, S3.
If you look back at the screenshots of how the console looked like, I was like, oh exactly. My God, like it just looked like something from the 90s or something.
Yeah, you know.
But I remember the old Amazon website, like Amazon.com.
Yeah.
Like it took also a very long time before they changed that, no? When I look back at these screenshots, I'm like, what is that? Did we order from that website?
That was the thing. That was pretty funny then.
EC2, S3, SQS, those were the first services. And there was not much more. SNS. I mean, obviously there was more because I remember when I was there in London, Lambda came out. And it was like, oh, what now? Yeah. And Docker was new. There was no Kubernetes. I mean, it was maybe it already started, but there was no 1.0 definitely.
No.
Spark was new, Apache Spark was new. Hadoop was kind of before all these new technologies existed. Hadoop was new. There was EMR on ALS, so you just put a lot of instances on ALS. have three masters, have a lot of nodes, and then run your big data workload on ALS. And then back then we were still running a lot of on-prem. Hadoop was mainly a product to run on-prem.
Absolutely.
To do calculations, to do ETLs, to do machine learning, even back then, on those clusters. And yeah, there was a need for compute, and then Amazon was there. Wait, but Azure was not there yet. Was Azure? Azure was not there yet, no?
No, I don't think so. At least not, maybe it was planned or whatever. But I don't know. I can't recall actually.
Yeah, but I'm sure they were there. It just, I don't know why, but everything was like AWS. AWS just had these services like SQS already that were like, okay, you can have these managed services and Lambda then and not really have to run everything yourself. And I think that was what was more appealing. That was why everyone was like looking at AWS as well, I think. And actually the price was still dropping. That was crazy. Like the price every year, every couple of months was like, oh yeah, this got cheaper. You don't see that anymore now.
And the object storage, especially in the big data space, that you could just like offload a lot of data, put in S3. That was also, and that doesn't need to be on disk somewhere or whatever. That was also a big thing.
We would still have these clusters would run on not SSD, even they would run on spinning disks.
HDD, yeah.
Those cheaper, and then Hadoop was also built for spinning disk.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I think it was around that time as well. I experimented with a couple of times with it, and then I think we find our first client back then. So somebody reached out to me because I was tweeting about AWS and was like, "Hey, do you know AWS?"
Yes, we started doing those are side business. When I was still in London, and then you were like, "Okay, we can set up AWS for you."
Yeah, exactly. I think that was the first client. We didn't have something incorporated yet, actually, together back then, I think.
No.
We were just like, let's try.
Yeah, but we set up something very small, but I don't think it was anything big or anything. It was just like, oh, yeah, this could actually work. And I think we started to have discussions that, like, we could do this.
Yeah, exactly.
But then it still took some time. Because I was still in London. I was still actually at that time I was giving big data training, so I was also away a lot. I would go all over the world, literally, to give big data training, because back then it was like kind of a global thing. It's like there were not so many trainers, so I had to go to San Francisco one day, and I actually it was like I had to go to Seoul in South Korea to give a training, and then like, oh, but they also can you also give a training in San Francisco, because you know you're already traveling anyway. So I would then go like around the world, because then I would fly more east, and then I'm in San Francisco, and then I would fly east again, and I'd be back in London. So
in already 2 weeks time, in the neighborhood, just, kind yeah. of, yeah, like
yeah, I was already halfway. Actually, not really, but
no.
Yeah, so that was quite funny, and because yeah, people, big companies, enterprises want to know about this technology, and then yeah, indeed, definitely. it was not really a side business. It was more like a proof concept, I would say. Like oh, this is like oh, you know, consulting, yeah, that could work, but you first joined another company first. No, you first went to join Spark Central.
So it was in the same time frame actually, because I was quite vocal on Twitter. Back then about AWS, somebody reached out to me. I was like, hey, we're looking for a DevOps engineer for our SF-based startup. So we're expanding to Belgium as well. So it was a Belgian guy, Davey, and he said like, and he founded a company called Spark Central in San Francisco. And I was like, yeah, we're going to come to Belgium because then we have to... HQs basically, so we can expand in Europe. We have a team here, a team there, and we need a DevOps engineer. I was like, oh yeah, this is a bit mind blown. San Francisco, to circle back to the beginning of our conversation, like what I wanted to do in 2008, kind of around that period. And I was like, oh wow, this is like discussed it at home. Everybody was like, yeah, thumbs up. Now it doesn't give the overlay of the thumbs up, but whatever. And I was like, yeah, let's do that. Basically, like also they weren't very familiar on how doing like how to give you a wage and stuff like that in Belgium. They also still had to figure it out. But I was like, well, we'll figure it out. No worries. So, but everything was okay.
Yeah. Jump on a plane.
Exactly. And then jump on a plane, go to the San Francisco Bridge, like take the Uber, go to the Golden Gate Bridge. And I was like, yeah, finally here. And then like at some then AWS became my main priority. I already had some experience with it, but I wasn't like super experienced yet. I did a couple of projects and stuff like that, but also like I said, weren't that many services that you could choose from. So
no, it's not like AWS today, right?
Exactly. And also it was like basically used as a like server provider basically, so they all had pets, nothing automated, everything was like click together, and basically then I went from Oracle DBA to experimenting with AWS and getting our first proof of concept client to full-fledged DevOps engineer living in the center of the epi wave of AWS basically.
Even today, like an app. Okay, you already had microservices, but like database would be so important. And it was like, then you had RDS. A lot of people were not on RDS yet. This was actually quite important skill to have to like, if you know about databases, you have to do this migration, you have to do high availability, maybe even before RDS.
Yeah. Oh, that's maybe also important. Like the Oracle DBA was not solely Oracle DBA. It was like in the DBA team, because I was also responsible for MySQL, SQL Server, not that much, and MongoDB. So it was MySQL, MongoDB, and Oracle, basically what I was doing. So it was not full only Oracle that I was doing, but was like a small part of it was MySQL. And that was also super important, like you said, because you had a self-managed MySQL with self-managed backups and all that stuff, which apparently didn't always work, but that's a different story. With a slave that then would do the backups and then disconnect and then do a consistent backup, because that was also some magic that needed to be done back then. And then I was like, yeah, let's move to... I think we first moved to Percona Galera cluster to make things easier. And then you have like three master nodes that could redundant with a HA proxy in front of it. So that was pretty crazy actually, to manage the growth of the company. And then you all like, it were always like those projects that you had to dive into and use all your skill sets in order to like, and you try to set it up with Ansible, stuff like that. That was pretty fun. That was, I really enjoyed that time of, like building stuff.
Yeah, it's very interesting if you're in a startup that actually is growing, and where you as a infrastructure person have to kind of follow. Well, if you cannot build out the infrastructure, the app will just stop working at some point. So,
And it's your problem because you're the DevOps person.
Yeah, to make sure that it can scale, and those are the interesting problems. If you are in a company that is actually getting more users, scaling the user base, and then you have to scale.
Need more servers, and then load balancing, and then ALB came around, stuff like that. So you were able to offload that to AWS, and more things you were started to be able to go to managed services.
The beginning days of AWS was like, you would run everything yourself, kind of on EC2s, and every time there was a reinvent, it's like, oh, we can do this managed, we don't have to manage it ourselves anymore, you offload it, okay, pay a bit more, it's like, indeed. And then at the end, so many years later, you kind of don't have to manage anything anymore, everything is now managed for you. I don't say anything, but compared to what we had to do the years prior, it's like the system engineering skill set was so much more important because you had all these technology that you would have to manage, you had to know about, that could kind of give you an error at some point, and you have to investigate. And now you're a different abstraction layer. Now, AWS has already built those technologies as managed services, and then your job is just kind of to manage them. Yeah, because it is indeed also still a good thing that you don't have to manage all these things. And now, okay, maybe also you would need less operations people in your team too, because you have less technologies to manage. You can actually do a lot of things yourself using a lot of different technologies, because you don't have to go and do deep dive anymore, because they are now managed by AWS, or part of it is managed by AWS.
And also do more useful things.
Do more useful things, yeah. Yeah.
Who enjoys doing AppCat updates or whatever, like of important web servers? Like, if this goes down, like, production is broken, like stuff like that.
I remember going back to the days where you put servers in racks. There were so many single points of failure. So many, you know, like, you were like, and if you have an idea of what you set it up so you have an idea of what it is, and there's so many, like, if this fails, we are in trouble. If this fails, we are in trouble, you know. And then back in the day, it was like, if there was a hardware failure that you couldn't immediately solve, you would have to get into your car, drive to where the servers are located, get an access code or badge in or whatever, and then walk through the rooms, and then open the rack, and then
roll the table with the screen on it, connect a screen and a keyboard to it, and then see what is actually going wrong. Same with doing remote changes.
Yeah. Pressing the button was not really the issue, because I remember you could like power cycle servers, right?
Yeah.
So it was like, can you access a server? No. Let's power cycle? No. Okay, there's something wrong with it. Drive? Okay, there's a hard disk failure or something. But not even a hard disk failure, because then if it was RAID, so that wouldn't really be the issue. What, like, there was so many
memory issues, CPU.
Like overheating, or indeed, like, what could it be, you know? Like,
absolutely.
I once had a server, and I would open it for the first time, and it crashed, and the hard disk was not screwed on the chassis. So that, because back in that day, indeed, it would go to some kind of company that would put everything together. Like, okay, you had a motherboard. They would come like in a server chassis with motherboard on it or something, and you would still have to. But yeah, that was before hot swap.
Like micro surf. No. How is it called, the brand?
Supermicro. And that's so funny. I forgot about the name completely. Like, we would have Supermicros a lot. Yeah. Like,
still today, they're being used a lot.
Haven't you seen the stock price in the last month or 2 months?
No, not really.
No, you should check it. So Bloomberg reported on it. It's like, okay, you have NVIDIA AI wave. But Supermicro is also going on this AI wave. Because they are supplying the hardware and the machines, and it's completely crazy. I literally, for 20 years or something, I didn't go to the Supermicro website, and I was like, I know this company. Like, where does it come from, you know? But I think the stock went down a bit because people were like, maybe not. because they just build hardware. I mean, it's definitely necessary, right? Yeah,
Yeah,
maybe
definitely.
they would not really follow Nvidia because Nvidia is really like building, making the chips, the GPUs. I don't know. I don't think Supermicro does make the any GPUs. They just assemble everything and sell it, right? So yeah, Supermicro. So where are we now? Yeah, so we kind of both now have all these
Experiences and
experience from from different industries. I think that is the most interesting part. If you are like in DevOps, it's like the more exposure you have to all these different parts, like, oh, you are a DBA, or like in DevOps, if you are a DevOps engineer, or you're in operations, or you're a cloud engineer, or whatever, if you come from, you often come from another, because it's like a more senior job, so you often come from somewhere else as a DBA, as a developer. So you bring something to the table. That's always what I find interesting. If you come from a different background, you bring something to the table that your colleague doesn't, was never exposed to.
definitely.
You, maybe your colleague is a was a developer or wasn't an audit compliance, you know. So, and together you kind of have all these different background to solve problems, to give your insight, because whatever role is in this kind of dev space, that is not a developer itself, it's not only about automating, it's not only about
No, true.
provisioning on cloud. There is indeed like it's still this organizational changing the organizational structure in a way to have like short feedback loops. Like a lot of the things that you want to implement are actually not very technical, but there are technical solutions to do the actual implementation of what you want to achieve. And that's what I find interesting. That's why it's so interesting to have people from different backgrounds in this role, and it makes it a good fit.
And not only that, you bring a lot to the table, but also because you know so much about a lot of topics, you're also sometimes like a bit of the catch-all of like, where are we going to put this? So that's where the flexibility and the eager to learn has to come in as well, because there will always be things that fall through the cracks, and that's all of a sudden not your problem, because I don't want to call it that way, but it's something. Let's say, oh, we need a VPN. Like, oh, but you don't have an, you know what I mean? Like, those things. And that was,
Yeah, in small companies, right? Not in bigger companies, you maybe it's more part of the network team, engages with some kind of vendor.
exactly.
But yeah, in smaller companies, you're like, oh, how do we access your service that you just put up?
That's also what trickled my ADHD brain. To like a lot of stimulus, like a lot of change, a lot of, it's not like a DBA. Optimizing a query, like stuff like that, and which is enjoyable for some people, but not for me that much. And then basically, we already are now getting close to the like founding
When we founded
Infra IT, right?
InfraIT, so in 2015, I think I said, okay, big data. I'm more interested in again infrastructure, which goes then back actually to putting servers in racks, but instead of putting servers in racks, it's you deploy on AWS. So I was like, I want to do something cloud DevOps instead of big data. But then I was like, am I going to join another company? So I didn't really know what to do. And at some point I was like, not just to go back to Belgium. I mean, I wouldn't say I've seen it here in London, but then I was like, London is very expensive to start your own company. So I was like, if I'm going to start my own company, don't need any funding. I just want to bootstrap it. Let's spend some time in Belgium. Super cheap to live compared to London. So I have a long runway and I will figure out what I will do. So I think May 2015, again, went from London to Belgium. Didn't know anything what I like vaguely, yeah, maybe something with cloud DevOps, but I didn't really know what to do. And then kind of spent 6 months a year doing lots of different things. I was still giving some training, some big data training now and then as a consultant. And then we started meeting, you know, we want to do something. Let's incorporate a company that we can do some work together. So we did that. But then I was also interested in okay, I did this big data training, but you have to repeat always yourself. And like, I started doing training to get the ALS certification, and then I was like, oh, people are doing online training. So it's 2015, right? Online training. I can do online training. So then I started doing online training of cloud and DevOps topics and big data topics because I was like, I know all this information. How easy would it not be to just say, like this, like what you need to know to start becoming a cloud engineer or to
Yeah,
work
the hard
within
skills,
DevOps
basically, yeah.
space, the hard skills, yeah. So then actually my first course was just like how to get into DevOps. What is DevOps? What are the technologies that we used, Chef, Puppet, Ansible. I think those were the main like software development life cycle. And then Docker was new. I mean, not super new, but it was there. Kubernetes was there, but it was also almost not used because it was, I think, just 1.0 came out just then or something. So I had like very small topics on that. And then I was also doing some consultancy here and there just to see in also in big data space, still in Hadoop from Belgium. And then I actually saw the training taking off and I was like, oh, they seems to be really a demand for cloud DevOps. Actually, that's mainly DevOps. Maybe
Kind of an
a little bit less
understatement,
cloud.
but I
Yeah. Back in that day, Udemy would still send you emails for every person that would enroll in your course. So I would put the first course online in November or something. Then I would still do consulting, so I was at the client. And then I would check my phone and I was like, all these emails suddenly in January, I think. I was like, what? Are these all enrollments? And indeed, they were all enrollments in January. They did like this big promotion, Udemy. Like, oh, it's a new year. You should learn a new skill. And then so many people are like, oh, DevOps, DevOps, DevOps. And then I remember, like I typed in DevOps in 2015 on Udemy and I was like, I was nothing. I was
Yep,
like
exactly.
one of the first courses. So then I did a Terraform course, Kubernetes course in 2016, I think it was. And then we also started working together more, first clients in consulting. So we did both the training, online training, and the consulting. I got my AWS certificates because I was also on Udemy doing the AWS certificates. And yeah, it kind of all kickstarted from there. We got some bigger clients at some point, all from the US. And then it was us in the plane again. To
Yep.
the US to talk about Istio and Docker and ECS and all these technologies. So yeah, then we actually started working together and now then that's when was it 2021 I moved again back to the US for the to work on those US clients. And this is our situation now, right? So we still run the consultancy company, we still have the online training. A little bit of less of online training, I would say, than back in the day, because now there's so many more players. That's why you started our podcast.
Exactly.
Indeed. Why, like, okay, you have the training, but podcasting is so much more interesting, also. I mean, maybe not, I mean, for us, it's also interesting.
Hope for the people listening as well or watching, but
Yeah,
nevertheless.
what I mean is like the training, making the training. Is not very interesting. It's like it's a grind. It's like every day recording, cutting, recording, cutting, recording from 1 month, 2 months until you have a training ready. And then you don't know whether it's going to be successful. So you have to work for 2 months and then you put it out and hope that there you have enrollments. So we had like good courses, but also had courses that didn't have many enrollments or that are very difficult to
But it
support.
still brought a lot of value to the people who actually needed it. But it's like you said, some things that were so moving so fast that it's hard to support them in a training, like especially a training like that, because
Like a Spinnaker
like
course.
Spinnaker, yeah,
Yeah,
exactly. Like
it didn't become a Kubernetes. It's more like, yeah.
it was broken for so long that I don't know which service it was. The install would break and they wouldn't fix it. It was like, yep. That's basically it, and it was a pull request open, and like that, some Debian package moved away or whatever, and they didn't care to replace it. But then you're providing support to a training, but you have to say, yeah, but it's not our fault. It's like the actual project is broken, but a lot of people are interested because they hear about it, and yeah, that was not easy. But like, yeah, that kind of summarizes how we
And then, like, also in the beginning, we did everything ourselves, and now we are more working on an architecture level, I would say, where we actually have cloud engineers that work for us, that do the actual kind of work, the implementation. We do more architecture level, or also some troubleshooting, maintaining some code, best practices, modules, Terraform modules, and so on. So, yeah, maybe in general, the technologies that we use now is we are very much focused on AWS. Terraform we use a lot. Kubernetes where necessary, but more a fan of ECS. Like we did some videos on that as well, like some podcast episode on why we think ECS is probably a better fit than Kubernetes in most cases, not all cases. Big data technologies we also use, but now it's more like Spark in packaged in a AWS service glue. With S3 as a storage backend, not really Hadoop. We're trying also to still get rid of the Hadoop clusters that are running that we didn't even build. Like they were set up so long ago that you still want to get rid of and use something else like HBase. Yeah, you can migrate all this stuff to managed services. So we are still working on that. It's not like you would think, like from a bystander point of view, it's like once AWS comes out with the managed services, oh, it's like, now we use the managed services. But now we are 10 years later than these managed services came out, and we are still like, well, we are still running some instances that nobody wants to log into anymore because everyone's scared that they will break something, and we still need to move it to a managed service.
And I was watching a YouTube video a while ago, and it was interesting that you mentioned it because now AWS starts charging you for outdated services that you're running, like that you need to upgrade them. And it was like somebody making, which kind of makes sense, but I found it interesting. He was making a point that like if you install it yourself on your own hardware, like in your data center, you can keep running it forever, like on that version. Yeah. And then I'm like, but do you really want to do that? It's kind of a good way that they incentivize to move forward to but obviously then the application needs to be changed and stuff like that. You're talking about a lifespan of, I don't know, like Postgres, it's like 10, 15 years. Maybe it's time that you move the application to a newer version, right?
With databases which are so deeply embedded in the whole application, it's not really a big issue. But I see the issues with something like that can have security flaws because things are not maintained anymore. Yeah. Libraries are not maintained anymore. Something that has a lot of libraries and you don't know what libraries they are. And that's often difficult to find and to know about. So it's like it's often an unknown in a company. You're running this old Hadoop cluster. Well, is maybe something still exposed somehow? Like think about this log4j bug, right? Can something be exposed in some way that it can be suddenly pose a risk, a security risk? And that's why it's indeed interesting to, when you're still paying AWS all this money, it's still supported. If there's a security bug, AWS guarantees that they will fix it. They will patch the RDS, Postgres, and you don't have that certainty if you indeed run something yourself, it's complete the end of life.
Absolutely. But I'm gonna kind of cut you off here because that's like we discussed it before recording the show. That's for our next episode. So we're gonna continue. Indeed. Like it's a nice flow transition to
we can just like the next episode is exactly gonna be about managed versus unmanaged.
Exactly.
So we can just continue
seamless transition.
Seamless
transition. Okay, let's make a mental note. Okay, I always wear these kind of shirts, but then we can just cut
and wear the same shirt and then as if we did it in one.
No, absolutely. And okay, we'll speak soon about that topic. I think that summarizes
that was our journey.
Kind of our journey. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I hope people enjoyed it. That's it from my end. Thanks for the chat, Edward, and let's see each other soon.
Next week, and then we will talk about managed versus unmanaged.
Exactly, and open source versus closed source, I think, as well.
Yeah.
Because that goes kind of hand in hand as well.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
All right.
All right.
Take care.
See ya. Bye.